Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I have a very, very special guest. I'm really honored to be speaking to Jo Hedwig Deowisha, or she's better known as Fake History Hunter. She has a huge, huge Twitter account with lots and lots of followers, and her expertise is debunking historical facts. And today, and she has written this wonderful book, which was published by Penguin Publishers, called Fake History, 101 Things That Never Happened. And today I'm really honored to be able to speak with her. Yo, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you.
I need to apologize to you because I know I kind of butchered your name.
That's quite all right. It's a very, very Dutch name that only Dutch people can really pronounce.
Before we get into the questions and talking about the book, I would appreciate if you could tell us a little about yourself, how you became interested in history, and more particularly, why are you known as Fake History Hunter?
I've always been obsessed with history for as long as I can remember. As a child, I grew up in a very old house, and my parents also had an interest in history, and we went to visit museums and castles and things like that. And I remember as a little girl suddenly realizing that there was a past, and I thought it was magical. And everywhere I looked, I was surrounded by history and I couldn't stop seeing it. And I made it my job, my career. I was very lucky with that. And then one day I was on the internet, just looking around Twitter for a little bit, and someone shared a photo of 1920s girls dancing. And I thought, there's something wrong with the photo. That's not 1920s. And by that time, I had been a historical consultant for film, television, and museums for already a couple of years. And, you know, doing research was my job, or still is my job. And I really love it. I'm addicted to it. So I thought, I want to find out more about that photo. And then I discovered that it was a 1950s photo of people pretending to be from the 1920s. And I posted that on Twitter and people liked that. And I thought, maybe there's more fake history on Twitter. And, well, those were famous last words. It's full of it. And so I decided, let's go and try to do something about it.
Wonderful story. Yeah, and I must say that there were some of the stories you have in your book and some of the stories you have debunked on your Twitter account. I used to believe in them, and I'm not a naive person, but some of them are really difficult to be able to see through. But we'll talk about that. So Fake History Hunter, 101 Things That Never Happened. How did the idea of the book come to you? I know that some of the materials in the book are from your Twitter account, the ones that you have already debunked on Twitter account. But here, maybe for the benefit of the audience, maybe you should also talk about the structure of the book. Like, you start with the myth and then you debunk it, and at the end you have some reputable resources to prove the points you're making. So can you tell us about the idea of the book?
Well, the idea of the book didn't come from me. When my account got a lot of attention in the media, I was interviewed by, I think it was the BBC History magazine, and it got a lot of publicity. And then I got several offers from publishers who contacted me and said, we think this might be a good book. I wasn't planning a book. I wasn't planning any books, really. But they convinced me. And so I thought, let's go write a book. And the publisher gave me some advice on what they think would work really well. And I thought the idea of starting with the myth, you know, because that's how I work. That's how I find them on the internet. That's how I find these myths, that they are given to me, they're shown to me, and then I start correcting them. And, this is how most people know the story. So that's the thought, you know, let's put the myth at the beginning of the chapter. You know, this is what you probably believe, that you may believe, but you may have read somewhere. And then I start debunking it as hard as I can. and I throw everything I've got at the reader. And, you know, then finally I throw in a few sources just to prove that I also didn't just make it up. Because, you know, it is important that you don't really blindly trust anyone just because it's in a book or just because they're a professor or an expert or a historian. You know, if someone can't prove their point, you have to remain, you know, critical. You have to. So that was very important. And that when I say to other people, if you can't prove your claim, it has no value, then I should also prove my claims, you know, just to be fair.
Mm.
So that's how the book came about. Other people said it was a good idea, so I thought, let's do it. And that's sort of how the book works.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Was there any selection criteria in these stories? You have 101 fake pieces of history here. Was there any selection criteria, or they were just random things that you've come across in your career?
It is a bit random. I try to when I started, I thought I probably should do this in different sections with different themes, or perhaps per era. But it, because you know, some errors, because of my personal obsession, are a bit over. There are more chapters about certain errors than others. And you know, some subjects are more popular than others. So it was very. I originally wanted to put some sort of theme or division in the book, but then I thought, you know what, this is how it works for me on Twitter. It's very from one chapter, from one subject to the other. So I eventually just gave up on trying to put it into little boxes and just went, right, here you go. These are all very, very different, very, very strange chapters. And I just put anything in that I could think of that either I thought was a very interesting story, that a myth that a lot of people believed, or that I think showed very nicely how to do research, or it was a good example of being a bit of a history detective, because you know that. So either the story is important or fun to read, or the research is interesting and fun to read about. But in the end, it was also about some chapters. Simply, we couldn't get permission to use the image that the story was about, and without the image, sometimes the story doesn't work. So that's why some chapters had to be replaced by others. Some of these I wrote or worked on many years ago, while others I worked on literally days before I put them in the book, because you know, new myths keep coming. And that's also very interesting and exciting. And then, you know, then suddenly I said to the publisher, you know, we've got this thing going on now with artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence, and this I've just corrected this story, and I think it might be interesting to put in the book as well, about, you know, others I worked on almost a decade ago. So there's a bit of chaos in the book.
But
the book came about.
Mm, mm. But I when I was reading the book, I could still see maybe not so much patterns, but there were a lot of connected themes. Let's say medieval history, of course, World War, pop history. But you're absolutely right. There's so many misconceptions and let's say fake histories about so many different subjects that it's really difficult to be able to categorize them into some categories. But anyway, out of I myself a huge fan of medieval history, and I really enjoyed the ones that you've debunked in the book. One of them is that millions of women were accused of witchcraft and burned at stake. That's so let's talk about some of the myths you have in the book. We won't cover all, but we'll talk mm-hmm. about some. So I would appreciate if you could talk about women being witchcraft and being burned because of doing magic, maybe.
Yeah. There are these claims that we all know about the witchcraft trials and how women were all burned at the stake. And for some reason, we like to connect the worst of history to the Middle Ages. It is a very, very welcome target, you know, a scapegoat. Dirty things, evil things, torture, witchcraft, burning, you name it. We automatically almost in our brains think, oh, that must be the Middle Ages. But especially with the witchcraft trials and the terrible things that happened, because they did happen, you know, let's not pretend it didn't. That mostly started after the Reformation, you know, after the Middle Ages. It was a post-medieval thing. It was a Renaissance thing, an early modern era thing. You know, the time that we like to think of as being much more advanced than the Middle Ages. But in reality, in the Middle Ages, the general consensus was that witchcraft wasn't a thing. Even the church said, no, witchcraft, you know, if you think someone is a witch, you're suspicious. Because why would you believe that? You know, what's wrong with you? at the end of the Middle Ages, there were witches being persecuted and even executed. But the main number of victims came after the Middle Ages, and they weren't millions. They were probably roughly, you know, it's difficult to be sure. It's all a bit of a guesstimate. Probably about 30 to 80,000 victims of witchcraft, mostly women, but not exclusively. Some historians say it may have been as much as 200,000, which is still an awful number, of course. It's terrible. But not millions. And people sometimes have, you know, not sure why it's being exaggerated. And, you know, it doesn't make it any less bad what happened by saying it was tens of thousands that died. But it wasn't millions. And it's those little things that, a lie doesn't make the story any better. It doesn't make it any more poignant. It doesn't make, you know, doesn't give it a bigger impact. So, it's, you know, there's a bit of exaggeration and connecting it to the wrong era, which is something people do a lot.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And whenever I talk to my friends and tell them, look, which burning witches, it actually happened during, most of it happened after the Middle Ages and during Renaissance. Yeah. They're just puzzles. It's impossible. I've seen it in movies.
Yeah, and mostly they weren't even burned. I know, witches were generally hanged. But which is also not nice. But the burning of people that was for heretics, you know, there was a special, you know, they didn't just go around and set fire to people for a laugh. They had rules and laws, and you know, if you were accused of witchcraft, you were given this kind of punishment, but not burning. Yet somehow in every film, in every television series, a witch is executed, well, you know, start fire. It's very fascinating to try and figure out why we want it to be burning, and it's now in the general, you know, mind. This is what we imagine when we think of the witch trials. It has to be burning. It's always fun to try and figure out why do we think that.
And there are two other myths about the Middle Ages. One of them is that it's a time where progress simply stopped, knowledge stopped, and everybody was illiterate. And you have the myth that you have included in the book is that the Middle Ages, in the Middle Ages, nobody except the clergy could read. And the other myth that is really annoying is that it was just filthy. Nobody took a bath. They knew nothing about basic hygiene. And again, you have this one in your book. So can you talk about these two myths, let's say, and debunk them?
Yeah. The idea that medieval people could not read or write, it's mostly true. The majority of people were not literate, what we call literate. But it wasn't just the clergy who could read and write, because it's very handy to be able to make a few notes, to do some basic writing. But the problem is that we do not have much evidence. And that's because books were very expensive and people wrote them on parchment, which, involved literally getting the skin of an animal and preparing it. Books were special and, valuable books. That's what, people put in their libraries and were very careful about. And, they survive to this day. But what people, what we seem to forget is that a lot of people, the normal people, the common people, they wrote on birch bark, on wood, on pieces of bone, on walls, they wrote on lots of things. And I think that there was a lot more writing and reading going on than we think, but it's very difficult to prove because these are all materials that, they don't last very long. You try writing on a piece of wood and then you throw it in the fire when you no longer need it. But archaeologists have found these things. For instance, in Russia, in a very specific area, the ground had this certain level of, not quite sure how to describe it, but the ground there somehow managed to save birch bark for centuries. And they found all these letters people had written, and even homework and drawings made by children. And, someone threw them or they dropped them in the swamp or whatever. And just for this very small part of the medieval world, we have all this writing from common people. And it's really nice to read. It's, people writing, Dad, can you send me some new socks? Or, I love you and you love me, let's get married. It's all these very normal, very familiar things. Pieces of writing that come to us from the past, but we also have these little pieces of wooden writing from the Vikings who also scratched their runes in little pieces of wood, about normal things, common day-to-day things. So I think there was a lot more, but we can't really prove it because only in a few places here and there it was saved. But if you put that all together, you get very tempting evidence that suggests that maybe writing was a lot more common than that. And people for a very long time said that literacy was probably 1%. In the last couple of decades, that's already been changed to 10%. So 90% illiteracy is still very, very high. But I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to change that number a bit more in the future. But one of the main things that really annoys me about what people say about the Middle Ages is that it was dirty and filthy. Don't get me wrong, compared to our modern, very clinical way of life. Yes, medieval life was dirtier than ours, but so was Victorian life and Roman life. But yet somehow when we think about the Romans, nobody mentions the dirt and the filth. But when it comes to all the Renaissance, that's sort of on the side. It's not important. But when we talk about the Middle Age, it's almost the first thing people think about. we immediately imagine someone opening a window above us and emptying a chamber pot into the street. We see mud, we see filth, we see people who never bathe. And that is, it's mostly nonsense. Bathing and washing was very popular. It was a part of daily life. Bathhouses were they were fantastic. Every village, every town had one. They even had, in some parts of Europe, they had free bath days. So if you didn't have any money, there was a specific day where you could go for free. Some workers were given bathhouse tokens as part of their salary, so they could go to the bathhouse 3 times a week. People washed and they did their laundry and they cleaned their houses and they cleaned their streets. And I remember reading in records, people writing about how someone got into trouble with his neighbors for littering. You know, someone threw a little bit of food or something like that on the street and the neighbors came out and they wanted to punch him. There was a fight and it had to be taken to court. And, you know, people saying, he was throwing things in the street, so we beat him up. And you read that and you go, this does not fit everything Hollywood has been showing me.
Yeah.
And, you know, the records are so full of these things. And it's almost like as if people, when they're researching history, they look at a page in a book and it's in the old records and it says, we have the medieval city and it is the Middle Ages today. And we have all these problems with filth. You know, there's filth everywhere. And then they close the book and they say, right, now I know what medieval life was like. Instead of, you know, turning the page where it says, so we did something about it. And then you get this whole list of these are the new laws that stop people from, you know, littering and making a mess and polluting our water because we need clean water. You know, we need to drink it. We need to make beer. We need to do laundry. So we need clean. So it's very important that people don't pollute our water sources. And you read all these and you think they have more laws on what you can do, you know, about the environment than almost more than we have. And when you start looking at it from that perspective, suddenly you realize that so many things, especially about hygiene and, you know, general cleanliness of the Middle Ages, is that people have been teaching and talking about for centuries. It's just nonsense. It's very, very strange to discover that.
Let's talk about some other myths that you've included in the book, maybe more contemporary ones, and I guess a timely one. There's one myth that would never ever go away, and every year, every Christmas, it just comes up again, which is Santa wears red because of Coca-Cola. And yeah, I guess every year you have to debunk this.
it's already started, you know. It's November, so. It is a very tempting one, and people seem to have a problem with understanding the difference between popularizing and inventing. Because, you know, fair due, Coca-Cola absolutely popularized that look of Santa. You know, the jolly fat man with the red suit. When they went full advertising mode with Santa, they spread that image all over the world, and they still do, you know, almost daily. You know, they have sort of adopted Santa, to use nice words. But they were not the first. Santa, exactly as he is today, as he looks today, the same guy, same suit, same color red, was already, very popular, especially in America. It was used everywhere, even in advertising for other sodas, which I found very funny, because, you know, there you was advertising a drink long before Coca-Cola did that. And luckily, this is one of those myths that's quite easy to debunk, because we literally have advertisements, magazine covers. There is so much art from before Coca-Cola got involved that shows Santa just the way he looks today. But just because they read somewhere that Coca-Cola got involved with Santa and used him everywhere, and then after that, the old image of Santa was sort of forgotten, and people in their brains sort of turn it into Santa was invented by Coca-Cola. So you can understand where this myth came from, which is not always easy. But in this case, you sort of get it. But, you know, it's wrong.
And maybe another contemporary one is that Thomas Edison invented the light bulb.
Yeah, again, it's the same sort of idea what Thomas Edison did is he got a lot of inventions from other people, put them in a new fresh package, put a nice bow on top, and commercialized it. He was the first one who got an invention that already existed, but he showed to the world how you can use it, and how it can work and how it can change our lives. And because he had so much money and support, when he got financiers and other folks and the media to visit his laboratory, he said, he flicked a switch and he said, look, I've got lights everywhere and I can make them cheap and I can make them work longer and they're really cool. And everyone thought, wow, this is fantastic. But we forget that there were light bulbs already being used in public long before Edison got involved. Of course, they weren't as good. You know, let's be honest, Edison did an impressive job of making the light bulb more affordable and smaller and last longer and things like that. And when I say him, I mean his laboratory and his workers. But you know, they had light bulbs, and some of them didn't last very long, and some of them were way too expensive to use. And you know, I'm not saying they were really good, but they existed. And when you want to say that you invent something, it's about the first person who did it, and not if it's not the best one.
Another one that I didn't know myself until I came across that one in your book. And it was funny because when I read about it in your book, then I was listening to another interview somewhere else and somebody else mentioned the same thing, which is Newton. The idea is that he came up with a theory of gravity when an apple fell on his head, but apparently it's wrong. And I didn't know it myself until I got the book. Can you talk about this one, please?
Yeah, I rather enjoyed this one because it used to be, I don't remember the name of the cartoon, but I remember as a child reading a cartoon where Newton was shown being hit in the head with an apple.
Same thing with me.
And I really, I didn't quite understand anything about gravity or this theory of it, or that's way too complicated for me. And I'm not quite sure I do today. But that's an image that stayed with me, because as a child you like people getting hurt in cartoons. When I tried to figure that one out, I went to see, where did the story come from? Because, when you grow up, you automatically think that's a bit too good of a story. You know, it's almost as if someone made it up just so that children in school pay more attention, which, it works. But I already sort of assumed that it was probably not true because it was such a funny and a cool story. But then I also tried to figure out where did the story come from. And, pretty soon you realize that he did have a sort of a revelation when he saw apples falling from the tree in his garden. So there was a tree, there was an apple, it did fall, but he wasn't sitting underneath it. It didn't hit him on the head. And the great thing about Newton is because he was already so well known when he was still alive and very, very respected, is that there were, not direct eyewitness accounts, but friends and people who knew him who wrote, how he was talking about what happened. He was saying that he said to his friends, I saw an apple fall from a tree. And that's almost as good as it gets when you're looking for evidence for stories. But it didn't fall on his head. And that is mostly based on a French book written at the time, which was very popular, where one man wrote to a friend that perhaps the apple fell on his head, or Newton's head. And that story was picked up, put in another book, and before you knew it, it was quite popular to this day. And that was so fun. That was a really fun story to research, because you can almost be sure that that is where you can almost pinpoint the birth of the myth. That is always very, very nice to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another one was about Nazi salutes, which has Roman origins, which is, of course, wrong. And that I, again, didn't know myself until I read about it in your book, and I found it quite interesting.
Yeah, it was probably just made up in the 18th century or a misconception. Someone made a very nice painting about Romans, and they were given a sort of salute, and people loved it. It became a very popular painting, and people decided to... And then suddenly this image of Romans giving each other that salute was slowly woven into other books and stories. And before you knew it, it was everywhere. And then, of course, the fascists in Italy, who wanted to give themselves more credit and more value and more importance, they decided to do that by, stealing history or adopting it or making it theirs. Because if you have history, somehow you become more important, become more credible. So they say, we are continuing the Roman way. And they started saluting each other. And, in reality, if you would get a Roman with a time machine to 1920s Italy and say, oh, look, those fascists are giving each other the Roman salute, you probably would have gone, what on earth are they doing? Because there is no evidence for a Roman salute, for one that everyone used all the time, but for one just like it, there were salutes similar to it. People, there were several salutes and greetings, and some we know about, some we are not quite sure what they look like, but they're mentioned here and there. But there is no real evidence of a Roman salute that looked anything like the one the Nazis and the fascists still use, unfortunately. Till the 18th century, and which is something that happens quite regularly when you try to figure out the origin of a myth. It is quite suspicious how often we end up in the 18th or 19th century. You think, what were they making up history on purpose? Because it happens a lot, especially the Victorians. They are cheeky.
Just a final question. We live in the age of information. There is data and information everywhere. You just mentioned there is AI. There are lots of fake videos, and there's ChatGPT. It can easily create lots of information or even pieces of history. So what kind of advice do you have for people who want to sift through all that information and be able to read critically?
I think the most important thing when we're being swamped and swamped and flooded by all these stories, is that we look at the source. People who are saying these things, where did they get them from? Just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true. If someone said, I was taught this when I was a little girl in school, and someone was telling me tall stories. We were taught to say, well, prove it. if you wanted to fight with someone, you said, yeah, well, prove it. And you should, I think that's a really good thing to keep in your head when you're reading things. Where is the evidence? Where is the proof? You don't have to go deep dive into the archives and just to be sure. But there are so many stories out there that don't even have any references. There are no sources. There are no mentions of history books that they used or archives. There's nothing. People just write a story and people believe it. You have to remain critical. You have to go, why would I believe this? Why would I believe you? The person who writes it, are they an expert? Are they have they spent lots of years doing research? Do they know what they're talking about? You have to be very critical and don't blindly believe anything anyone ever says. But on the other hand, you have to also be careful not to go too far, because we live in a world where people don't believe anything anymore, and that's also not good. When a medical expert tells you something, it's probably get a second opinion if you must, but don't just start assuming that all the doctors are always lying, because that's also nonsense. So try and look as good as you can at the source of the story. Where does it come from? The person who's telling it, do you think that they know what they're talking about? Can they prove what they claim? And if you have a little voice in the back of your head saying, well, this is a bit of a tall tale, you know, chances are that it might not be true. And especially those stories that are somehow made to make one group of people look so much better than another or worse. There's often something there that's a bit fishy, because, you know, history doesn't always work like that. You know, real history is black and white, but also gray in between. And if it's a very simple story, very one that makes something work very, very well, a very smooth story, when it's almost too good to be true, it might be, actually be too good to be true.
Thank you very much, Joe, for your time. It was a great conversation.
You're welcome.
I really, really encourage our listeners to first follow you on Twitter and then buy the book. It's a fascinating book to read.
Thank you.